Hey everyone, it's Dawn Sarah with this week's episode of Sex Gets Real. Joining me this week is a consent expert. I just read his new book, Can I Kiss You? So welcome to the show, Mike Domish. How are you?
I am fantastic. Thank you for having me on, Dawn.
You're so welcome. So let me tell the listeners a little bit about you and what you do, and then we're going to roll around in all things consent and communication and some current events.
Yes, there's plenty there going in current events, sadly enough.
I know. I was so happy to see you had posted some stuff on your Facebook feed about, like, just all of the scandals and conversations. So I was like, perfect, we can talk about that. For those of you who don't know Mike Domish is one of the leading experts working to transform our sexual culture to one that's being built on consent and respect. For over two decades, he has educated families, colleges, military, and individuals all about consent, respect, and dating. His new book, Can I Kiss You, is inclusive and great for all ages and genders, sexual orientations, and socioeconomic backgrounds, which was something I was so thrilled to see when I opened the book. All the names are gender neutral or as close as you can get, and there's zero pronouns in the book for the most part. So I really love that because I feel like that's one place where writers and educators go wrong. So I'd love to start there with you, Mike, of what made you decide to make Can I Kiss You gender neutral and inclusive to all genders?
Yeah, it was pretty easy because what happened was we do the Can I Kiss You program on university campuses, schools, military installations for organizations. And in there, we're highly inclusive, and all the names I use are gender neutral. And so the first book I ever wrote was May I Kiss You? And in there at the beginning of the book, we say, while the names may imply gender, imagine it being yourself. And I realized that book is too far behind the time. It was at the time it came out in 2003. And I'm like, I don't want that. I don't want that representation. It's not what we do. It's not how you bring people into a conversation by saying, oh, just switch as if it was you. We wanted to make people read it in a way that was them, that they could say, okay, that's me or someone I know, without having to play a mind game of, it says Michelle and Mike, but that sounds heterosexual, but I'm not. I didn't want them playing that mind game to have to feel included in the conversation. I want them to read it and just feel like, oh, that could be me, or oh, that could be my friend or my family member, so that everybody could be part of the conversation, because this is happening to everybody of all genders, all identities, all orientations, and we wanted the book to bring that in right from the start and continue that throughout.
I'm so glad to hear you say the words, that could be me, because I know I've had Karen BK Chan on the show, who is a sex educator based out of Toronto, and she does a lot of work around consent by bringing in kind of non-sexual social experiments and the ways that we pressure people to do things they don't want to do, like dance or have that drink, and how those behaviors make it so much easier to do the same thing when we're talking about kissing or getting naked. And it's so hard to get people to understand the importance of consent conversations and communication when we vilify the people, when we vilify violating somebody's consent, or when we vilify not asking, so that we can say, those are the bad people, and I would never do that. And then we feel like we're not part of the problem, so we don't have to examine our own actions.
Correct. And most of our culture likes to do that. They like to say, well, I'm not a rapist, so I don't need to have this conversation. So what they do is they use the vilification as a reason they don't even need to engage at all. And yeah, that's really unhealthy and dangerous. And one of the things that we love in our work is that we do get to work with audiences of all relationship statuses, of all ages, socioeconomic. So I could be speaking one day to a sixth grader, but the next day I could be speaking to a 55-year-old military leader. And they might come in and going, hey, I'm not at bars. Why do I need to have this conversation about alcohol and sex? I've been married 30 years. And an example I'll use is, say, all right, you're in the backyard with a bunch of friends. You're all couples, and you're having a cookout. And there's a lot of drinking going on. and your partner comes up to you in front of your friends and is getting all handsy and flirtatious with you, and your partner walks away. And they've been drinking a lot. What do all your friends say to you? Everybody in every audience knows the answer to that. They're like, well, somebody, if not everybody's going to say, you're getting late tonight, or you're getting some tonight. And I go, okay, yeah, which pretty much just implied that if your partner was sober, you have no chance. But because they're drunk, you have a chance. And audiences start laughing at this, going, oh my gosh, that's so true. Yeah, and we just described people have been married 30 years intentionally using alcohol to have sex. The same thing you're yelling at 18-year-olds not to do, you're doing in your marriage. And you're saying you don't need to be part of the conversation. And so that's how we have to look at this. Like, how are we all part of this? Where is this showing up in very complicated, subtle ways sometimes at all levels of relationships, all ages, socioeconomic, orientation, identity, all of this, gender? How does it all play a part in my life? How do I relate?
Yeah, I have talked to so many people who struggle inside of their marriages because our culture tells us that there's this assumption that when you're married, you automatically have access to sex. And there's this like cultural story that it's okay to guilt our spouses into sex or to withhold sex and to kind of use our bodies as either weapons or as something to use, because marriage and being in long-term relationships kind of automatically transfers those rights. And it can be really challenging to start trying to talk to people about, if you've been married for 20 or 30 years and you're just starting to realize, like, I don't really like these dynamics, having conversations around that can be really intimidating.
Oh, it's incredible. We'll be towards the end of our program, and so that we wait till we have a comfortable, very comfortable atmosphere with an audience, when we share the following question to go home and ask your partner. And before I tell you the question, I'm just going to tell you that people, when I say it, you see half the room go, oh, that would be awesome, which means they're not using it. Because they say that would be awesome, not that is awesome, I already do that. And you see the other half of the room go, oh my gosh, I don't know if I could do that. And here's the simplicity of the question. Look your partner in the eyes and say, what would you love for me to do in bed for you tonight? And half the room is like, oh my gosh, that would be great. And the other half is going, what are you saying? I can't talk that way to my partner. Wait, how long have you been married? 30 years, but we don't talk that way. And you don't see, do you see the problem? And when they're speaking out loud in front of 500 people, they actually hear themselves. And they're like, and they start to explain why. Well, we were never taught to have a voice, or you were taught that might be uncomfortable. And yes, and you should be able to have a voice. And yes, it should be comfortable. So how do you start that conversation? Go home tonight and work with your partner on being able to have these conversations. And they report back, they've been married 30 years and they've never had that conversation. It changes their intimacy forever when they start having those conversations. They're like, why did it take 30 years for me to have this conversation? Why didn't I learn this at 18 years old, how to do this with my partner? Or even at 16, so that if I was, even whether it be kissing or more advanced intimacy, I had a voice. That becomes that much more important.
Yeah, one of my favorite parts of your book is at the end of each chapter, you have links so that students can go find things, parents and teachers. And I went and I specifically looked at the parent link for each of the chapters. And I thought it was so powerful that you were giving parents an opportunity to not only like reflect on the messages that they're modeling as parents, but also ways to have these conversations with young kids. And one of my favorite things that you had was when you were talking about how easy it is to misunderstand body language, because we have this tendency to project what we want it to mean instead of actually understanding what it does mean. And you were asking parents, if you're upset, frustrated, or disappointed by your child, and you see your child giving a look, in quotes, do you assume what your child's body language means, or do you inquire with sincere interest?
That is huge.
I thought that was fascinating.
and it's hard to do because our natural reaction wants to say we know what they're saying, even though we don't. And I'm a parent, so I come from this from the perspective I've been there. I'm not just telling parents, here's what you should do, even though I've never had to live it. And so I do get that this is difficult. But we do this with our children. We do this with our partners. They roll their eyes. And we think, oh, my gosh, how dare you? You're disrespecting me. Like, you're acting like what I just said doesn't matter or it doesn't have any credibility. They could be rolling their eyes because they can't believe they actually didn't know that. Like, oh, my gosh, why didn't I think of that before? When you have that same thought go through your head, your eyes appear to have the same roll kind of eye look as, I can't believe you just said that to me, you idiot. Like that exact same look can be, or yeah, oh yeah, duh, right? A duh look. But the duh could be, duh, mom or dad, I know that. But it could be, duh, why didn't I do that? Duh, mm-hmm. Right? And yes, right? Am I clarifying? What we'll say with audience all the time is, hey, watch body language, never rely on it. Confirm with words. Mm. Confirm with words. So if you think your child's doing something to disrespect you, confirm with words. Hey, I noticed you gave this look. Have I upset you? Have I made this uncomfortable? Did that feel like a lecture at that point? Or was something else going on that I'm misreading? You know, ask, what's happening here? I don't want to assume.
So I want to touch on the confirm with words piece a little bit, because actually I'm going to circle back to it and I'm going to start with something first just so listeners can kind of follow along. So in the book, I thought one of the most powerful sections was where you said, when we interpret body language, we project our hopes and wants. We see what we want to see, not what they want us to see. And then we look for things that confirm this projection, so that we're super biased when we're reading body language and the communication from someone that we want something from or that we find attractive. And I thought that was just such a succinct and powerful way of explaining why, if you're out at a bar and you are just kind of like smiling at the room, one person might take that as like, oh yeah, they totally want me. And how that can lead to like really confusing interactions, because you want that person. So of course, if they smile in your direction, you want to believe they're smiling at you.
Yes. And that happens all the time. And then people will blame the person who is smiling instead of the person with the, I know what I want, and I'm the one interpreting the smile. And that's the person who made the mistake. It was the assumption they made by a person. And what you described happens all the time, right? Imagine you're sitting amongst a bunch of your friends. And one of your friends goes, hey, that person over there is checking me out, right? And you all look and you're like, no, they're not. They're checking out the person 5 feet behind you, you idiot. You know? But everybody's been in that moment where that's happened. But we all want to believe it, right? Hey, that's the person I'm noticing. They're noticing me, right? How many times have we all, this example I'll give, how many times have we waved it? We saw somebody waving our way. And we so want to believe we're being acknowledged because that feels good. We waved back to realize they are not waving at us, and this is extremely awkward. And we're like half pulling our hand back down because we don't want to look like an idiot. We've all done that, right? Yep. And it's because we want to believe we're being acknowledged. It feels mm-hmm. good. Even if it's a totally nonchalant situation, just somebody waving as you're walking down the street, we want to believe somebody notices us. It's somebody who knows us.
And I'm just going to kind of like, you talk shortly after this in the book about how important it is for us to get really clear on not only our values, but all the things that make us valuable, all the things that we do that prove we're a good and valuable and worthy person, because obviously the more confidence and the more self-awareness we have, then the less we're going to rely on kind of those external validators to make our choices in dating and meeting people. And I feel like the people, like, for instance, a lot of listeners go to like dungeons and play parties. And I've had the experience where I've been at a dungeon and I've seen like a lone individual who every single person that makes eye contact with them, they immediately go up and feel like, oh, this person wanted me to approach them. And you see them doing it over and over again. And I feel like it's because that person is feeling so insecure and so unsure of themselves and wants something so badly that they're completely misinterpreting all of the signs from everybody in the room because they just need someone to validate them. versus the confident person who is able to, my guess, is read all of those cues with a little bit more honesty because the other people in the room aren't going to validate their self-worth. Do you think that's true?
Well, I think it's an interesting one because I think even the confident person, if they see something they want, will also misinterpret because of their bias. Mm-hmm. The difference might be that the one is misinterpreting all of the messages and the confident person is only misinterpreting the one they want. So maybe another way to look at it is the confident person is assessing the room to what fits what they want within the standards they want. Mm-hmm. And there's the key difference. The other person's assessing any opportunity, not to the standards they want. So they're walking in with anything is good. The other person's walking in with, I'm looking for a certain experience. And so they're going to be more selective to fit the experience they're seeking. Where somebody who's seeking any experience will take anything. It's just like if somebody goes out to a bar and says, I just want to get laid tonight. Anything they can see as an opportunity to get laid, they see everything then. The person who says, I want mutually amazing sexual experience tonight, they're going to see the room very differently because they're mm-hmm. only going to be looking for partners who they think are sexually mature, who have confidence. They're not going to prey on vulnerable. They want both people to have a voice or all people to have a voice. So they see the room differently because of their selectiveness or lack of selectiveness.
That brings me back to what you said about confirming with words. So we want to use body language and nonverbal communication as input, but because there's so many ways to misinterpret or to put our own bias on it, we want to make sure then we confirm with words. And I think that's a really powerful practice. I also think that it can be a dangerous one if we aren't also aware of the potential power disparities at play. So if it's like a white man approaching a black woman or a very tall person approaching a very short person or a very wealthy person approaching somebody who maybe is a little bit younger and doesn't have means. Would you agree with that?
I think, yeah. So here's the importance of that element. I'm glad you're bringing this up that is so important. And that is understanding one's privilege. Understanding the power dynamics in a relationship and making sure that your partners always have an equal voice. So if there are cultural, socioeconomic, many different demographics that can cause what you're just referring to there, where there's a power dynamic potentially, how are you ensuring that your partner has a voice? There are certain cultures where, for instance, one gender over another gender has an automatic power. And if you walk up and say, will you do this for me? Or we're in a sexual situation, I say, would you like to do this? The person's going to feel they must say yes because of a dynamic they've been taught. So therefore, even though you're asking and they're saying yes, it's not what they want to do. That's not mutually wanted, enthusiastically given. It's already been taught they must say yes. And so that's why you want to make sure that you establish a sexual relationship with partners where you truly, your partner understands you do not want a yes because you asked. You want a yes because they want it. And they really want it. You don't even want a, I guess, yes. You know, because people say, hey, may I kiss you? I guess. No, that's not a green, that is not the kind of green light you should want to move forward on. What's that intimacy going to feel like? I guess. I want to hear yes. Yes, or whatever way you want to say it. Some people put other words in there to make it that much more adamant of a yes. And some people like to be, you know, more direct. Some would call it vulgar. Some would call it blunt, whatever. As long as the two of you like that language or all, you know, whatever number of partners are, they like that language. That's what's important. So, yes, I agree with you. Establishing what your sexual relationship is and how that can impact all partners is very important. And people say to me, well, how does that work in a one-night hookup? You really need to be able to engage in a sexually mature conversation then. And if you're seeing red flags that something's missing for this to be a sexually mature relationship, hey, notice the red flag and pay attention to it and acknowledge it. Don't say, well, we'll keep moving and see how that goes. No, 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 no. Acknowledge it. Use words and acknowledge that you're asking not because you want them to say yes, because you'd love to experience this if they absolutely, truly want this.
The There's so much power in what you're saying, and I love it so much. And where I get a little bit like discouraged is I feel like the current climate of the way we have raised our kids, especially when we're talking about like heteronormativity and raising boys to be boys and girls to be girls, is that, you know, with toxic masculinity and kind of the way we socialize boys, so much of their value is determined by being able to acquire sexual conquests. And I think even as people start kind of unpacking that for themselves a little bit, there's still kind of those, we are so rejection averse and so like failure averse as a culture that it can be really difficult to retell those stories we have about when someone has the opportunity to say no, because we're so afraid of even giving them that opportunity that then all of these, you know, really mixed messages and really dangerous situations start happening.
Well, yeah, and it's why we need to be able to share. You already are getting rejected all the time, but you don't want to talk about that. So the current system sets you up for horrible rejection. And you use it every day. Not you. I mean, our culture. Our culture's current system sets people up for rejection all the time. And then they go, I'm not going to ask because I'm afraid of rejection. And I go, okay, let's pause that. You just go for it. Your partner doesn't want it. What could happen? They could turn away from me. Is that humiliating? Absolutely. The person will tell you, yes, it is. They could push me away. Is that humiliating? Oh my gosh, yes. They could slap me or worse. Okay, is this just awful? Yes. And this is your current system, and you're telling me you don't want to ask because you're afraid they could say no. Instead, you're using a system that could humiliate and be incredibly uncomfortable for both of you. Well, I never looked at it that way. Yes, because you've been told a story. And that's the key word you use there about untelling the stories we've been taught. It's not that they're afraid of rejection. It's that they've been taught that right now they don't face it by just going for it, even though they do. They're being taught a myth that is so false that they don't, and they've been taught it for so long, and it's so false that it's dangerous and they don't even recognize it. Mm-hmm. And so what we're doing is just pulling back the curtain and going, let's look at what you're really doing. Does it make sense? And when you do that, people start to realize the stories they've been sold are absolutely false. They're myths. But we need to first pull back the curtain to say, let's look at what this really looks like. And when you do that, people are like, oh my gosh, that's so true. I've been there, done that. It is messed up. And then what you do is you get the person going, but what else can I do? And then they're seeking the better solution. And mm-hmm. then what's great about that is then you say, well, what if you asked? Now they're owning the solution because they recognize their current system is failing them and they want a better option. And if you go, what if you ask? Well, then they'll tell you all the barriers to why they don't ask. Okay, let's look at each of those. Are any of them logical? And when you look at all of them, none of them are logical. I'm afraid it's going to ruin the moment. Okay, you're already ruining the moment. Give it up. Don't kid yourself. You're not that smooth. All right, so and people admit that. They're like, that's true. Yeah, I'm not that smooth. I don't care how long you've been around. You still can be awkward. So that's a false one. I'm afraid they're going to say no. Oh, heaven forbid you give them a choice. And they're like, oh my gosh, that sounds awful. Yeah, it does. And you just said it. They're like, oh, that's awful. Correct. Right? So what are you left with? You want an approach that gives them a choice and yet that you're both empowered and it can be fun and sexy. You look someone in the eyes and say, may I kiss you right now? If somebody says, well, that ruined the moment, you are talking to a sexually immature person who is not comfortable with language attached to sexual choices. And we're not trying to degrade the person by saying they're sexually immature. We're trying to help you recognize this person is not used to having a voice. They don't feel comfortable having a voice. And that's not to degrade them. That's to recognize you might need to slow down and help them learn how to have a voice. But if they don't want that discovery, you might need to move on. Why do you want to be in a relationship with somebody who doesn't want to have an equal voice with you or doesn't want you to have a voice? That's not healthy. So there's two different people you can run into. The person who recognizes, I'm not comfortable with that. Okay, are you willing to become comfortable with that? Nope. Okay, we're probably not going to be a good fit. Or the person who, I'm not comfortable with that because I just don't want to engage with you on that level. Okay, we're not a good fit. that's okay. All right. And then on the flip side is the person who goes, well, I'm not comfortable talking that way. Well, what if you could become comfortable? Like you could have a voice. I would love that. Okay. Well, I'd love to explore that. Mm-hmm. Now you have a win-win.
Yeah. And I think so much of it has to start with, you know, it's really wonderful when as adults, we start asking ourselves these questions. And so we start challenging ourselves to try new things and to change the way we relate to each other. But it can be so difficult, you know, once you've had 30, 40, 50 years of feeling like you don't have a voice to suddenly be trying to find your voice and to understand your boundaries and, you know, and it's even harder, I think, when you're a sexual assault survivor, which everyone on the show, you know, have heard my stories and other guests' stories about how that even compromises the power of your voice more, and how much more powerful it would be if from the time we were born, the way we were raised was by parents in a community that told all of us there's value in both our yeses and our nos, so that we're not only teaching people how to be resilient around no's, but we're also teaching people that it's okay to say yes to the stuff you want.
Correct. One of the powerful things that I love is, when we do a live show or presentation, at the end, people can win books and t-shirts that we have. And all they do is raise their hand and share something they're going to use from the program. And what's really amazing is sometimes someone will raise their hand and say, today, I realize that I can say yes or no without guilt. Which is so powerful. And they might be 40 years old, and which means they've had this restriction on their life, not that they chose, that culture put on them, for 20, 30 years. Mm-hmm. And what they're saying is, you know what, I can say yes without guilt, which means I can own my sexual being without guilt. Or I can say no without guilt of I disappointed somebody and that makes me feel guilty. So I'm not going to say no. I don't want to disappoint them. Culture's told me to be a pleaser, to make them happy. I don't have to do that anymore. I have the right to make this choice. That when that happens, you're just like, that's like the moment of the light bulb going off where you're like, this is why we do what we do, because everybody deserves that choice. And it's so important because usually when you say to people, you deserve to have a choice, they think to say no. No, you deserve to have a choice to say no, and you deserve to have a choice to say yes and say it like you mean it and you want it. And how sexy is that for your partner? May I? And you answer yes. I was just like, yeah, let's roll, right? I mean, this is what it's all about.
Yeah, and I think where some people get hung up is the fear that they'll never find someone who's going to say that yes, so they better just go for it in case that happens.
Right, and what that's about is ego. And when ego is driving, ego doesn't care about partners. Ego's about me, ourselves, the one person. And it's incredibly dangerous. And so that's one thing we have to shift the paradigm in our culture that we work on is switching from a get some attitude to a mutually amazing sexual intimacy attitude. See, a get some is about ego. I get some. I'm going to get laid tonight. I'm going to get this. But if you say, I am seeking mutually amazing consensual sex tonight, well, that's not about just the I then. As soon as you leave the word I, everything else is about mutual. Mm-hmm. And it's about the partnerships that exist at that point. And that changes how you talk with another human being, how you interact with another human being, how you discover sexually with another human being, changes everything.
So while we're kind of talking about the culture and the messaging that we get, can we just talk for a few minutes about Trump and Rush Limbaugh?
Sadly, they are providing examples of why our work, and not just ours in our organization, anybody in this movement's work is so important. And how far we have come, and yet how far we still have to go. Where do you want to start?
We could go anywhere
on this one.
It's just, I think one of the things that I'm happy to see coming out of this is for the first time, I've actually seen some major media outlets calling it what it is.
Correct.
And I think the coverage of like the Brock Turner case was so terrible and the headlines around it were so just triggering and disgusting for so many reasons. So to see that in, you know, a fairly short period of time now, I know a lot of conservatives are just going to be like, that's because it's the liberal media. But to actually see people like Anderson Cooper on TV saying, you realize that's sexual assault. So I think that that's one of the kind of good things happening that's coming out of this. But it makes me sad that it has to come to this in order for us to start having these kind of like global conversations.
Correct. And so let's start at the Stanford case. The Stanford case, as you said, the headlines ran Olympic caliber swimmer, which made no sense about what was going on in that case. And that was some of the awful that went on in that case. Some of the positive is how outraged the country was at the sentencing. Now, the ironic part of that is that our country was outraged and thinking, thank goodness that doesn't happen very often. And that's where the country was totally incorrect. That happens all the time. That kind of situation frequently happens. We did a live Facebook feed that night video, and several people on my Facebook feed were responding, survivors, my rapist got convicted and less time. So, and you saw that over and over again. This was not an anomaly. This happens. So there were the positive was the country was upset. The sad part was how clueless we still are as a society of how frequently this is happening, how that was played as a marketing gimmick to try to get him less of a sentence, all of this. So there was positive, and there was a lot, obviously. There was a ton of negative in coverage. Now, of course, when you look at a case, it's always negative. There's no positive to somebody being sexually assaulted. But when we look at the media coverage and how society reacted, now we skip forward to Hollywood Access video with two people there. And it's interesting, NBC is paying millions to make Billy Bush walk away.
Yeah.
And very little is being discussed about that. Everybody's talking about, well, Trump made the comments, but Bush sat there, was almost cheering him on as the comments were being made. And NBC said that's not acceptable behavior. To cheer on. NBC's not treating it like quote unquote locker room talk because that person was being hired to give that interview and represent them.
Yeah.
And so there are some positives that NBC's taking on that. But yeah, let's start with obviously the video. You have a person, yes, bragging about what anybody would look at and say is clearly an act of sexual assault. I can just do this to a human being is sexual assault. Now, Anderson Cooper says, what was amazing about what Anderson Cooper said was, do you understand that as sexual assault? That the way he asked it was so powerful. And Trump never answered that. Never. And then when he said, have you done this? And he tried not to answer it. And Anderson Cooper didn't skip it. And he would, have you done this? And what is it, three times, I think? He said no. He never acknowledged, though, that even the description of what he said was sexual assault. Had he done that, people might have believed an apology. If somebody had come out and said, I look back on what I said 10 years ago, and I was describing an act of sexual assault that I would never want to engage in, and it was ridiculous that I thought that was cool or whatever, that's horrific. That's never what took place. And it would not excuse the behavior, but it could at least make you think some learning took place in that time or from this experience. But that's not what took place at all. Because most people in our culture, until they've had an awakening, with few exceptions, there are some exceptions where people have been raised in a way that is different than everybody else, and they, from a very young age, see these things, all of it, for what it is. But most of us aren't raised that way because our parents didn't get this education either. It's not that they intentionally did anything wrong. But usually most of us who get it, quote unquote, this topic and consent, at some point, we had an awakening to help us get there that went against culture. And so if you haven't had that at some point, it's harder for you to get what's so wrong about this conversation because nobody's had this conversation with you. And maybe you come from a place of privilege. You can't even see what's going on. And you're not willing to. That's the sad part. You're not willing to. And that's what we've seen happen nationally with this case. Now, the good side is how many people are calling it sexual assault. That's the positive side. Trevor Noah's piece on Comedy Central. If you haven't seen it, look it up. Trevor Noah, Locker Room Talk, Trump. Just look that up. It's an amazing video where he calls out the difference between locker room talk and which is sex talk and the difference in sexual assault talk. Mm-hmm. Most people are not engaging in sexual assault talk. They're engaging in sex talk, which can be highly inappropriate, offensive, and harmful, but not in the realm of sexual assault talk, right? So locker room talk that's inappropriate is, I could hit that, which mm-hmm. is violent, it's harmful, it's bad, and it's not the idea, though, I'm going to hit that against their will, or I'm just going to hit that. You're not adding that. People don't in the locker room never say, oh, I could get that. Even if they didn't want it, I'd force it. Nobody would say that in the locker room. And I grew up around sports and in the locker room. Nobody I've ever heard said that in my lifetime. And I get to work with athletes because of my job nowadays. People don't talk that way. But that's what that conversation was. Because I am who I am, I can do what I want to whoever I want. It was sexual assault talk. And it was horrendous. And we need more of our country to say, can we dive deeper into this? How did we mm-hmm. get to this place? Instead of only, and I have been one to speak out about what Trump said, but we need to take it beyond just a vilification of what took place on a video. We need to say, as a country, can we have a deeper conversation here?
Yeah.
That's what really needs to happen.
I totally agree. And using it as a way to say, if we take this really extreme visible public example, and we really look at the behavior that's being talked about, and then we look at it on a much smaller scale in our own personal lives, there's lots of ways that we have done either similar things or are doing very similar things inside of our own relationships with people, and being able to actually admit that so that we can say, wow, I don't really want to do that anymore. Like, there's got to be a better way is, I think, where the power is in using a story like this to actually have better conversations about, like, what can we change in how we're doing things?
Yes. And this is a great conversation to have with people because I know a lot of people go, well, I do have a really sexually healthy relationship. I would never do anything like this. Like, okay. Have you ever been in the mood, really in the mood, and your partner was just, it didn't seem to be in the mood? Well, of course, they'll tell me. Okay. Did you try to help them get in the mood? Ever? Well, yeah. What? Okay, so your partner wasn't in the mood and you tried to, instead of respecting their feelings and their choices, tried to change their mind. Are we now suddenly on the slippery slope?
Mm-hmm.
And they'll be like, well, that's so minor. That's nowhere near what we're talking about over here, which is the extreme behavior, the dangerous behavior. Really? Would you want your child, the moment they say, no, I don't want you to do that, to have their partner go, you sure? You sure don't? What if I give you a back rub? Would you want your child, when they're a teenager, starting to engage in sexual intimacy, being treated that way? Well, of course not. The moment they say, no, I want to be honored, is no. But now, because you've been with somebody a while, you think they don't deserve that same level of respect. And if we're all honest, most people's urges will sometimes put them in an ego, place of ego, and not always be that person we'd love ourselves to be as a culture, because we've been taught these roles of, well, try to change the mind, trying to do that. And when you have it at this deep of a level, what happens for people listening often at this point is they get offended. Like, okay, how dare you imply that I've done anything wrong like that? Or they go, oh my gosh, yeah, I've done that. And I guess it is on the slope. Where do I fit in the conversation? And what's interesting is the one who gets angry and goes, how dare you say I've done something wrong, is I don't know who's listening right now. So if you're listening going, how dare you say I've done something wrong? You're the one saying you've done something wrong, because I don't know what you've done. I don't even know who you are, and I don't know your face, your name. If you are angry right now when I say something like that, you're angry at the mirror. Mm-hmm. And why does that bother you? Because there's a possibility I could have done something wrong. And we've been taught never do something wrong. What if we were taught when we've done something wrong, learn from it, so that you don't have to be angry about the possibility of done something wrong? Instead, care about the fact, I don't want to do wrong in the future. I want to do the right thing going forward. I want to learn from this.
Yeah. Yeah, and I think we also have this tendency in our culture, because we aren't very good at having nuanced conversation in the stories we see in media or in the conversations we have when we're teaching and learning, that we tend to see like this black and white of you're good or you're bad, you're moral or you're evil. And so we tend to see a lot of stories like the Stanford case where something really horrific happens and then, you know, everyone's like, oh, he's evil, he should never work again, his dad should be thrown in jail. And it's this very extreme case. But the story that tells is, well, if I've violated someone's consent or if I've done something manipulative, then I must be evil, so I can't let anyone see that because all of this shame and fear comes up.
Yeah, well, so the reason I do this work is because when I was in college, I received a phone call that I have three older sisters. The youngest of those older sisters is 4 years older than me. Her name is Sherry, and I received a phone call that Sherry had been raped. I'm 19 at the time. My sister's 23. I was absolutely devastated, and I was in a place of anger, rage, about what I want to do to this rapist, this assailant, mm-hmm. this criminal. And over time, what would happen is this anger wasn't getting me anywhere. And I heard a speaker speak out about sexual assault. Now, this was back in 1990, 91, when you didn't have these conversations on college campuses. It was very rare. And I thought, oh, I could use my voice to do something. But part of that was me looking in the mirror and going, oh my gosh, am I part of this? When I heard that speaker, I had to look in the mirror and go, wait a second. I'm angry because somebody forced themselves on my sister. Have I even been in the ballpark before? Like, have I ever been out at a party and went back with somebody and just tried to kiss them without asking first? At that point in my life, I could look in the mirror and go, yes, I've tried to kiss somebody without asking them. Well, okay, that's extremely different than what happened to my sister. But it's the same concept of, do you deserve a choice or not? Or am I going to make you stop me or say no after I'm trying to do it to you? And that was a wake-up call that I had of, oh my gosh, if I'm really going to be angry about what happened to my sister, we have to look at this conversation about how does this begin at the most beginning levels of sexual intimacy, kiss, mm-hmm. hug, all these. Why don't we give people choices? And for me, that was a wake-up call of, all right, how am I going to change this for me? Now, how do I help other people have that opportunity? How do we create this conversation? And that's where this all began, because of my own, there was guilt. There was, I've done something along the lines of assuming I could kiss somebody. So what right do I have to be filled with rage over somebody that assumes they can use power over someone? Even though they're very different versions of how it occurred, it's the mindset of, You can tell me no or stop me if you don't want it, instead of you deserve to have a choice before I do it.
Yeah, we've talked at length on the show about one of the things that pisses me off so much. And I've gotten so many letters from listeners about the unsolicited dick pic that happens when you're doing like hookup apps and this like mismatch of the people who receive them and how like angry they get versus the people who send them and not understanding why it's a big deal. And what you just said, giving people the choice, is exactly why. It's if you're not giving someone the choice to choose for themselves whether they're ready to receive a kiss or ready to receive a naked picture or ready to receive touch, then you're putting your needs and your desires ahead of this other person's safety and experience.
Correct. Why not just send them the text? Hey, do you like to have a little fun with sexting, or does that turn you off? Like, ask, right? If you're going to text, I prefer you have the conversation. You know what I mean? As a conversation. But if you're saying, hey, but text first before you send the pic. Because if they're saying, you know what, that totally turns me off, why would you send the pic? Like, if your goal is to get this person sexually excited and that turns them off, you're being an idiot at that point. Like, why would you do that? I'll give you an example in my own case. So certain emojis are being used to represent certain genitalia, certain sexual acts, instead of the old dick pic or genitalia pic, whatever it is. And so I had told my wife about this, and she's like, yeah, that's not in any way interesting to me whatsoever. Like, just send me a smiley face. That's right. Way better than
I don't need an eggplant.
Right, exactly. That's right. She's like, seriously? I think that was her response when I first showed her this. She's like, seriously? I'm like, hey, I'm not going to do that because that's not going to, you know, help if we're trying to set a sexy atmosphere here. So,
yeah.
But that's the crazy part about it, right? People are doing things their partner doesn't like, and their intention is to create an atmosphere where the partner wants to engage intimately with them. Well, then find out what your partner likes to engage intimately with. And are you two on the same page? Are you both comfortable with it? Maybe your partner likes something you're not comfortable with. And you're going to go, well, I'm not comfortable with that. And that's okay. Because a lot of people are afraid, and we sort of hinted this earlier, but there's a lot of people out there who, for many reasons, are afraid to say no. For a multitude of reasons. That idea of saying no is scary. So have you two had the conversation that empowers each other to say no? That thanks for asking it, but that's not something I'm comfortable with or I want to do or not right now, where I only like to do that once in a million on a special occasion. But these things I love to do. I really love these things frequently. But that thing once in a million or that thing over there, don't ever ask me to do that. In fact, if you do, I know you don't respect me because I told you I'm not comfortable with that at all. And if I ever change my mind, I'll tell you. You'll never need to ask. I'll tell you.
Yeah, one of the things that I thought was really interesting in Can I Kiss You was you were talking about like saying yes to a pity date or saying yes to a pity kiss. And I think also in relationships, we'll often just do like the pity sex because we just don't want to deal with the conversation and the pouting and the passive aggressive bullshit. So instead it's like, fine, let's just do this and get it over with. And
what's funny about that is I use this example from stage that you're bringing up is you've been with someone 30 years and there are some times that on Thursday night you have sex, you roll over afterwards, look at each other like, why'd we just do that?
Yes.
And whenever you say that, people are dying laughing because they've recently done that, you know, or you look up and your partner's looking at TV. This is not a satisfying moment at all if those things happen to you. But yes, because this idea that we just have to, right? That's what I have to do. And that's messed up.
Yeah, I agree. And as uncomfortable as it can be to start learning how to have these conversations, like it's okay to mess it up and be awkward for a little while. And I feel like that's so often like the questions and the emails that I get here in the show, I get tons of questions about sex and fantasies and telling a partner about kink or wanting to open a marriage. But what they almost all come down to is people are afraid of rejection and humiliation. And so they're trying to find a way to get their partner to be okay with their fantasy or okay with their kink without actually having to have a conversation.
And or the key word is there that I want my partner to be okay with it. In other words, I want a yes.
Right.
Instead of, I want to learn how they feel about this.
Mm-hmm.
Those are two very different viewpoints. If my viewpoint is, I'm curious what my partner feels about this, I'm going to want to discover with them how they feel. If my viewpoint is, I only want to discuss this if my partner will say yes. Now it's a form of how do I get to a yes? Now it's a sales tactic. It's sales and marketing. It's maybe some coercion, maybe manipulation, because it's focused on me not being rejected. It's a focus on me getting a yes versus I wonder what my partner thinks about that.
Yeah.
You know, and that's a very different conversation. You can make that without ever saying me, right? You could say to your partner, hey, you know, you hear partners talking about this, all right, whatever the this is. What do you think of that? You know, and know that whatever you answer, I'm not like, I'm okay with however you answer. I'm just curious what you think about that because I don't want you to think I have a preconceived notion. And if they're like, well, here's what I feel about it. Okay, that's good to know. There was no rejection. It wasn't about you. It was about how do they feel about that.
Yeah. And what's interesting is I think we also, as a culture, tend to tie our self-worth to whether or not people reject ideas. And that's also where some of that self-reflection comes in of like, if I, let's say, I really, really, really want to try going to a dungeon. And if I bring up the idea of dungeons to my partner and they say, no, I'm totally not into that, I think that a lot of people have now tied themselves to, well, my partner's now rejected me. And that's why we need to elevate these conversations and realize there's such a difference in you, yourself, and your values and what you bring to the table versus these ideas that are separate from you. And you might really want the thing, But talking about the thing and you as a person are two very separate things.
Yes, and this is very Buddhist Taoism, the idea of detachment.
Yeah.
That what we are discussing is not who we are. Mm-hmm. What we do is not who we are, right? It's I can make a mistake. And this goes back to some of the other discussions we had earlier. Is I can make a mistake. That's not who I am. That's a mistake I made. It's not, I can detach my mistake from who I am. A caring person can make an awful mistake that does not appear to be caring at all. There's still a caring person who made that mistake. So the mistake does not own them. They do not own the mistake. They are responsible for it, yes, but it doesn't define you. And this is true in sexual conversation too, which is who I am is not defined by any of this conversation. It does not define me. If my partner says no, it does not define me. If my partner says yes, it does not define me. So if I have partners that always say yes to having sex with me, that doesn't define who I am sexually. No more than it does a person who always has people who says no. The person who you are is a person separate from the answers you get, separate from the times that you make mistakes and you have successes. If you ride either of those, your self-worth is going to constantly be on a roller coaster ride that is dangerous, unhealthy, and most have been taught, most of us, ride that roller coaster because it's what we've been taught. Where you did you win or did you lose? You lose, low self-esteem. You won, high self-esteem. But it lasts for what, a day or two? And then you're searching again to get that self-esteem back.
Yeah.
And sex is the same way. Mm-hmm. It's a rush and then you seek it again. And the only difference is between people when you talk to them, except for asexual, obviously that's different. If someone's asexual, they might not be seeking. But for those who are seeking, the difference is frequency of what they consider acceptable search, right? Mm-hmm. So if you, for one person, it's once a month and another person, it's once a day. That is what ties in their ego and what time frame they're working in of the rush of the high and the rush of the low.
Yes. I'm so glad you mentioned that because I feel like that piece does get overlooked a lot when we're talking about like communication and rejection resilience of, you know, it is so important to be able to receive someone else's no and know it's totally about them and not at all about you. But we sometimes forget that we also tie a lot of value to those yeses and that we can often see ourselves as being better or more worthy if we've had lots of yeses from lots of sexual partners, instead of seeing that the yeses and the nos really aren't about us equally. And so I love that you just brought that up because that I think is something that all of us need to chew on.
Yeah. I mean, how many of us every time we're naked in front of a partner want to hear our partner tell us that we're sexy? Everybody just about would love to hear the partner go, oh, you're so sexy. And what's that about? It's not about our partner. It's about us thinking that when you say that, that makes me sexy versus I already am. You just happen to say it. Right. So that's the difference. So I'll give you a great example. Scott Stratton has a show called The Unpodcast. And he was talking about the fact that when his book sold, I don't remember how many books it was, a best-selling book. And whatever the number was, people went, oh, see, proof, the book is amazing. And Scott was brilliant. And when he said, well, actually, the book must have been amazing when I finished writing it because it didn't change between when I finished writing it and those books sold. But what do? Yep. We waited to hear how many books the book sold before we said it was amazing. When the book was amazing before a single book was sold. Mm-hmm. We're all that amazing book. And unfortunately, we're waiting to see how many books get sold.
Yeah.
Instead of recognizing the book's been written brilliantly. And it's me.
Yeah. Oh, I love that. I feel like that's the perfect note to like end on because now everybody can just feel like they're amazingly written books. Well, Mike, I would love for you to share with everybody where they can find you online and how they can stay in touch with all the amazing work that you're doing.
Well, we'd love to have people join us in the conversation and become even part of the movement if they want. So they can find us at our website, which is we're with the Date Safe Project. So Date Safe Project, you think of it this way. You're going on a date. You want to feel safe and you don't want to feel like it's a project. DateSafeProject.org. And you'll find everything there. We have a store with really the book you've been talking about all along here, Can I Kiss You? But we also have posters and DVDs and we have really fun t-shirts and clothing and all the stuff that's on there. People love the underwear. We have some really provocative underwear that's also fun and consent driven. It's really, really wonderful. So they can find all that there in our Facebook. And I know Facebook is an easy way for people to find nowadays. So if you just go to facebook.com/datesafe, they'll find us there, like our page, and leave a comment. Join the conversation. We're all about conversation. We're all about consent. We invite you to become part of the conversation with us, Facebook, or directly by going to our website at datesafeproject.org.
Well, I will have links to your website and all of your social media on sexgetsreal.com for this episode. I want to thank all of our listeners for tuning in. And Mike, I just want to thank you for coming on the show and being so generous with all of your ideas and experience and talking about consent.
Well, thank you for deep diving into this entire discussion, Dawn. You do such a wonderful job in sharing with the world. So thank you.
Oh, well, thank you. Well, for everybody listening, if you have any questions or comments, please go to sexgetsreal.com. You can submit your questions anonymously if you'd like. And of course, on Facebook and Twitter at sexgetsreal. If you have anything you'd like me to pass along to Mike, be sure to send that over or just go visit DateSafe on Facebook. This is Dawn Sarah. I will talk to you next week. Bye.